Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The UN General Assembly got extensive media attention this week, but like recent years, most of the focus was on Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Several U.S. networks interviewed Ahmadinejad mostly about nuclear weapons. Almost all of them failed to focus on anything else. The same questions were asked last year and the year before. So how should the media cover the UN assembly? And who bothered to walk outside of the building to interview the people on the streets? Chad Bouchard was outside. He's a staff reporter for 100 Reporters, a nonprofit investigative news organization focusing on holding government and business accountable. Hi, Chad. Welcome to the show. And we are on the domestic front. We are talking about media coverage of how the oil and fracking booms are affecting small towns across the country. Kevin Hall is recently back from Sydney, Montana, where, quote, in this fast developing Western oil patch, the gritty side of America's new oil boom is on display with rising crime, a slain school teacher, rents that have tripled, and public resources stretched thin. And that's just the half of it. Kevin Hall's latest piece is called U.S. Oil Boom Comes with Trade-Offs and an Ugly Underbelly. Kevin is the national economics reporter for McClatchy Newspapers, and he joins us from New York. Hi, Kevin. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me back.
Great to have you. And we're joined by Evelyn Nieves. Evelyn is just back from Fort Berthold, North Dakota, home of the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation. And she writes, when the Black Gold Rush began, no one on the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation expected it to take down Main Street. No one imagined tanker trucks barreling up and down Main Street, back to back like freight trains, 7 days and nights a week. No one predicted construction zones that grind traffic to a halt as far as the eye can see. No one anticipated the accidents, two or more a week, and all over the rutted reservation roads, costing lives and shattering families. Evelyn Nieves is an independent reporter. She wrote this piece for the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, a venture inspired by Barbara Ehrenreich to produce stories on poverty and economic insecurity. And Evelyn joins me here in studio. Hi, Evelyn. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, Rose. My pleasure.
Great to have you. So, as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Kevin, why don't we start off with you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I saw it this week, but it was written last week. A fellow colleague in my office, John Landay, has been one of the reporters who has been questioning the story out of Libya and how the events transpired connected to Libyan government officials, I presume, or Libyan sources, certainly, who told an alternative version of events, a version of events that still hasn't been completely clarified. But I would point your listeners to Jonathan Landy on our website, McClatchyDC.com, and his reporting on the still-developing story as to what just happened in Benghazi.
So can you give us a little more detail on what happened?
Well, I think he made it clear in his reporting that this idea of a spontaneous attack wasn't the case, and this was on September 17th, he reported this, you know, many, many days before the administration kept continued to offer four different versions of whether it was terror, whether it was spontaneous, whether it was taken advantage of spontaneous, and it seems to, his reporting seems to tell of an event of a planned orchestrated attack.
Mm. All right, so kudos to your colleague, and we'll put a link to that piece right after the show on our website. And Chad, what about you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
You know, something I stumbled on recently, but it does call back to May. The Chicago Tribune did a fantastic investigative series on the history of flame retardants. It got plenty of attention at the time, but it's just coming around to my desk. But this is talking about chemicals that are put into furniture and household items, something like 80% of toys that are proven to be carcinogenic, and the whole history is just very interesting and sort of connected to the cigarette industry and their lobbying early on to make sure that people are not too concerned about cigarettes causing fires. So it's just a fantastic piece, and it's really zoomable. You can see just a piece of it. You can see some chairs on fire, which is always fun. Or you can dig right in and see some original documents and that sort of thing.
Well, it sounds great. A number of activists in California have been fighting for years to get these flame retardants out of everyday furniture.
That's fantastic. Yeah, it's a real serious issue, and it just seems like there's been a boondoggle, and there, you know, the stuff is still in everything that we use, from plastics and television to, like I said, toys. So it's a big concern.
So let's dive in here, Chad, and talk about coverage of the UN General Assembly. And I understand that you were actually outside of the assembly, and what really struck us was how similar the coverage looked this year to last year, even the year before. I mean, most of it is on the Iranian president and the Israeli prime minister. What was your reading of the overall coverage?
Mm-hmm. Well, I know I agree that the main headlines cover what's happening inside and with these carefully crafted geopolitical chess match speeches. And honestly, the substance there is just not, you know, it's been vetted by aides and advisors, and you're just not going to get much substance. And in fact, the deals that are important are not happening inside the General Assembly. There's no time for that, really. And so what's happened is the important stuff happens outside. And it happens at cafes. It happens at gala events that are thrown, in some cases, by corporations. So there's a real story developing outside that needs coverage. I would encourage anyone inside the complex to free themselves and take a walk around.
And how many reporters are we talking about? I mean, you've got reporters from all over the world in New York?
Oh, hundreds and hundreds of reporters. I certainly don't have a number, but the press passes are everywhere. And if you go down by the, you know, in the morning around 9 o'clock, if you go down by the complex, you just see streams of reporters with camera equipment going inside to check out the speeches, which are the main event.
And so what did you find outside while these big speeches were happening?
Well, first of all, there's a whole commerce part of this. New York benefits incredibly by this influx of some estimates are 50,000 staffers that are in the city during this time of year, and not all of them are inside, and some of them are just family members of diplomats, and they go shopping. And the New York, the Manhattan Chamber of Commerce loves this sort of thing, and it's a really important part of the local economy. But you have what you see is shoppers from countries where half of the people make less than $2 a day, spending lavishly at the Apple Store or going into Cartier or coming out of Bergdorf Goodman with shopping bags.
One of your colleagues wrote a piece. There's no byline, so I'm not sure who wrote it, but it's called "Austerity Not on Show." And they wrote about these visiting dignitaries hailing from impoverished nations where more than half of the citizens get by on less than $2 a day. And I understand that your organization, 100 Reporters, launched a Klepto Watch 2012 Name That Shame photo contest to promote government accountability during General Assembly Week. And you asked people to take photos of these dignitaries who were shopping at high-end boutiques and restaurants. Did you get much response from that? And what was the point of that?
Well, we got a kind of a mild response, but I have to say that this is meant to be a launch of an ongoing effort to empower citizens in New York and London and San Francisco and places where these people come to shop, and to keep their eyes open for moments when they see leaders of poor countries or entourages showing up in high-end shopping districts to spend. Sometimes we've seen our reporter there a couple of weeks ago, suitcases full of cash. Now, when you see suitcases full of cash, you know something is perhaps amiss, that cash is often used to skirt, you know, to be able to avoid tracking measures and that sort of thing. And so, yeah, we want to empower people to use their cell phones, which is a fantastic development for kind of citizen journalism, to use those cell phone cameras to catch people red-handed and to gather evidence. And what happens with this evidence, when once you publish it, people care.
Hmm.
It gets reactions from folks in home countries who, 10 years ago may not have been able to see this kind of viral media reaching their eyes.
Well, according to KleptoWatch 2012, Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda, stayed in the presidential suite at the Mandarin Oriental, for which his government paid $16,000 a night last year, and he represents one of the poorest countries on the planet. So it's interesting that you have people in other countries paying attention to this, wanting to know what their leaders are doing at these meetings.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, just on Thursday, a photographer took a snap of the Prime Minister, Mariano Rajoy, smoking a cigar on 6th Avenue, and that ended up all over newspapers in Spain. Hmm. And, of course, they've just announced austerity measures.
And massive protests in Madrid.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I attended a protest right outside the UN complex by Iranian Americans and Iranian nationals who they were protesting Ahmadinejad's appearance, but they were quite upset to find that state-run news had reported that 140 delegates were sent to New York for the UN General Assembly, and that's up around 80 last year. So the delegation is expanding, and they're bringing their suitcases full of cash and spending money in town while people are suffering.
Hey, Kevin Hall, you're in New York, and you've been a foreign correspondent. What are your thoughts about how the media cover the UN General Assembly, and how do you think they should cover this?
Yeah, I was kind of smiling and hearing on Mugabe's hotel stay, because I remember years ago when I worked in Brazil, the Thabo Mbeki, went on to be the president of South Africa. By the time, he wasn't yet president, and he stayed in the nicest hotel in São Paulo at the whole top floor, which I think at that time was roughly $30,000 a night.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, in terms of misuse of government money. But in terms of the coverage, as your guest had noted, these things don't tend to make news unless somebody takes off their shoe and bangs it on the table and threatens. They're really behind-the-scenes meetings, and there has been some controversy about should Obama have met with world leaders. It was interesting. I think there was a stat that this is the first time in roughly 20 years that there hasn't been a meeting with world leaders, but in the day of telecommunications, I'm not sure what that is supposed to do other than signal.
Well, let's stay on this. I'm glad you brought that up, because Margaret Warner on the NewsHour on PBS was at the UN General Assembly, and she said that the reason why President Obama did not meet with these leaders is because of the election, and he didn't want a slip of the tongue, and then Romney would make hay of it. And so he basically said, I'm not doing this. Hillary Clinton can meet with them. Is that significant?
No, I think it's part and parcel of the world we live in, that on both sides, I mean, unfortunately, when you think also about campaign proposals and the little detail, when we got these big issues beyond the fiscal cliff, how do we get our entitlements spending in order and things like that, that neither side is willing to put a proposal out there because it'll be demonized. And whether you like Paul Ryan's proposal or not, and most people haven't, he's paid a political price for putting something on paper, whether that was the right thing you put on paper. So I think our listeners and citizens more broadly should ask themselves, are we part of the problem as well if we're not going to have serious, are we ready for serious conversation on these issues, including foreign policy?
That is Kevin Hall. He's economics reporter with McClatchy. We're also joined by Evelyn Nieves, an independent reporter, and Chad Bouchard. He's a staff reporter with 100 Reporters, a nonprofit investigative news outlet focusing on holding government and business accountable. And Chad will be with us for another 5 minutes or so. So if you have any questions or comments about how this UN General Assembly was covered in the media, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. And Chad, you brought up the Iranians, and it's amazing. Ahmadinejad is on the outlets every year when he comes to New York, and for some reason the reporters love to talk about his character. and just how he treats the women in the interview. But the questions are always exactly the same. They're always about uranium, and that's all they ask. So how do you think that he should be dealt with? And, you know, if you had a chance to interview him, would you? And what questions would you ask?
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, this appears to be his last appearance as head of state for Iran. So I'm not sure we'll get another chance to ask the same questions again. You know, I'm not. Yeah, that's an excellent question. I'm not sure what I would ask him. Boy, I would love to have the opportunity.
Well, I mean, the people outside would say he should be put on trial for human rights abuses, but he's hardly ever asked questions about human rights abuses. And what did the protesters outside? What were they saying during his speech?
Well, they are saying that his government's not legitimate, and that they want to see real political change, and that you know, they posted large posters full of faces of people who have disappeared under his regime for you know, political reasons. And there are a lot of people who are here in the U.S. just hoping for change and wanting to go home under a country that they can get behind.
Rose, some of the coverage, linking back to your previous question too, was in some of his interviews he continued the anti-gay slurs, and I think that dominated it. What wasn't asked about uranium or destruction of Israel was his very verbal and well-known views on homosexuality, and he went down that road again as well. We actually met with him, not me, but our leadership, and we have a reporter who's missing in Syria, a fellow by the name of Austin Tice, who worked with us and with the Washington Post, and I don't know if your listeners are aware of it, but he's been missing for a couple months now in Syria, and so there's been an effort to help Iran through its ties to put pressure on Syria to at least give some answers as to what might have happened. So I'd ask your listeners to keep Austin in their thoughts and prayers as well.
And Kevin, how significant is this assembly overall?
In years past, I think there have been bigger, more pressing issues. I think it's, you think in recent years, there's been efforts to have kind of a coordinated approach to prevent a global slowdown. I guess you could say this one is marked by a lot less economic interest in the last 3 or 4 years. That's one way this has been different. I think it's a sign that the global economy, while not doing gangbusters, at least is not afraid of going too far backward. The Europeans are busy with their own debt issues and trying to get their house in order. The developing world is busy trying to keep inflation in check in the case of Brazil. And China is busy trying to have a soft landing. So I think, and they've been quite distracted with their own political transition. So I think this one would be characterized as one that's most of the world's looking at its navel and not looking at big international issues.
And before we let you go, Chad, can you tell us a little bit about 100 Reporters? We just recently found you, but the website is excellent, full of investigative pieces.
Thanks. So we launched about a year ago, and it's a small startup nonprofit, and we are focusing on corruption around the world and supporting reporters on the scene, on the ground in various countries. The name 100 Reporters refers to the number of reporters. We're not quite there yet, but we're working on having 100 freelancers around the world covering the globe and filing stories specifically on corruption and supporting, filling a gap, I guess, in media now with investigative reporting kind of been drawn back in a lot of newsrooms because it's so expensive. So I think the nonprofit world is answering that call, and 100 Reporters is part of that.
Well, it's great. Glad to hear that you're doing this work, and we'll definitely have you back. Thanks for joining us, Chad.
Thank you.
That is Chad Bouchard. He is a staff reporter with the fairly new 100 Reporters. He's also reported from Jakarta and Indonesia. And we're joined also by Kevin Hall with McClatchy and Evelyn Nieves, independent reporter. And Evelyn, before we go to break, you filed this report about fracking from North Dakota for the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, which is also a new venture started by Barbara Ehrenreich.
Yep.
And kind of similar to what Chad is talking about.
Absolutely. We're trying to do stories that are not being done and expose situations that have not been brought to light.
And with a focus on economic hardship and poverty.
Absolutely.
And so can you talk a little bit about what the process is like? Because there are all these new nonprofits, and we're all wondering, what does this mean? How do you get the story above the fray so we'll actually see it? Because that's the one of the challenges.
The Economic Hardship Reporting Project's process is to hire journalists to do stories that have not been done, pay them a decent wage to do them, give them the time to do them, and then present those stories to outlets so that they could be widely disseminated. That's the hope.
Kevin, you've been a longtime journalist. What do you think of these new ventures that are doing this really great investigative reporting?
I think they're fantastic. I would point your listeners also to projects in Maine and in Wisconsin. Both have, Wisconsin in particular, has been looking at the fracking issue as well. There are former independent journalists who've gone to the kind of the ProPublica model without the big funding. The ProPublica, for those who may not know, is funded partly through the Wall Street Journal and New York Times, but also big donations, and they've won a couple Pulitzers, or at least one now. But these smaller ventures are looking at it, and I think there is a very important role, particularly as newspapers are shrinking, and certainly newspaper staffs are shrinking, and television, for the most part, hasn't focused so much on investigative reporting as newspapers and print had. So I think it's a tremendous thing.
So, Evelyn, you have this piece out. It's running in Alternet and hopefully other outlets.
Right.
The North Dakota oil fracking boom creates clash of money and devastation. As an independent reporter, how do you go about finding out about this and then getting the money to be able to actually do the reporting?
I actually found out because I subscribe to a bunch of Native American websites and newsletters. And in one of those, there was a little item about people being displaced from a trailer park so that oil workers could be placed there. And I thought, what is this? And I had heard about Barbara Ehrenreich's project, pitched the piece to her, and she said, go find out and do a story for us.
That's great. And unlike a lot of the outlets that are paying $100 or $200, that's the reality we're facing now. You're actually getting the money that is needed to go do an investigation.
I think this is the first time since I started freelancing after being in newspapers my whole career that I actually got an advance on a story so that I could pay my way there, which was great since there was nowhere to stay there and life was really hard to be able to have some cash.
I understand you couldn't even find a place to sleep?
There was nowhere to stay. I stayed with everybody else at the Walmart parking lot in Williston.
So you slept in the Walmart parking lot?
I did.
What do you mean, everybody else?
Well, the Walmart parking lot in Williston has become a city unto itself. There's probably on any night, hundreds of vehicles there from all over the country, people who have nowhere to stay because there is no hotel room, no apartment. You can't find a place to stay there.
I mean, that's a story in and of itself.
It is.
Yeah. Well, Rose, that was kind of the focus of our story, and what she's saying is absolutely right. People from Williston who are working in the Williston area are driving 2.5-3 hours to Miles City in Montana because closer to the Montana-North Dakota border, you can't find anywhere to stay either.
Wow.
So they have to, they'll live 4 or 5 days in a car, then drive, stay in a hotel in Miles City for 3 or 4 days, then come 3 hours back.
Yeah. Well, hold that thought. We're going to go in depth after the break and talk about what Evelyn found in North Dakota and what Kevin found in Montana. We're talking about media coverage, or lack of, really, of how the oil and fracking booms are affecting small town USA. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
Back to your call in just a moment. All the stories you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable are posted at yourcallradio.org. And they're also included in Your Call's weekly email newsletter. It's free and easy to sign up for. Just click the email newsletter link at yourcallradio.org. And you can highlight the reporting you thought was valuable this week by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and it's our weekly media roundtable. Today, we are speaking with Kevin Hall, national economics reporter for McClatchy Newspapers. He's recently back from Sydney, Montana, where there is a new oil boom on display with rising crime, a slain school teacher, rents have tripled, and public resources stretched thin. And Kevin reports that's just the half of it. Evelyn Nieves is just back from Fort Berthold, North Dakota, home of the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation. And she writes that no one anticipated tanker trucks barreling up and down Main Street, accidents two or more a week on Main Street, costing lives and shattering families. And the deer have disappeared in this area. And we'll find out in just a couple of minutes why that is happening. Evelyn Nieves wrote this piece for the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, a new venture inspired by Barbara Ehrenreich to produce stories on poverty and economic insecurity. And you can find both of their pieces at yourcallradio.org. And if there are any new reporting projects that you find valuable, if you've been following them, it's really important to give them some publicity, because sometimes it's hard to get these pieces published and then to get them above the fray. So we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. And if you have any questions for Kevin or Evelyn about the reporting that they did in these small towns, we'd love to hear from you. And if you have a piece that you saw this week that you thought was done well, give us a call at 866-798-8255. And then just overall reporting on the oil and fracking booms. We often hear about fracking, but we hear about contaminated water. But when do we really hear about how this is really affecting small towns? You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. So, Evelyn, tell us just a little bit more about what this area looks like. So you've got a Walmart nearby that is just packed with people sleeping overnight because they can't find a place to stay?
Actually, where I focus my reporting on the Fort Berthold Reservation is about 75 miles from Williston, and that's the only place I could stay, the Walmart parking lot. So I commuted daily to the reservation from Williston, which before the boom, it would be about an hour and a half's drive, but because of the boom and all the traffic, it would take me about 2.5 to 3 hours each way to get to the reservation. So,
and what did you hear from other people sleeping in this parking lot at Walmart?
Well, a lot of them were oil workers or commercial truck drivers who just said, if this is what it takes, you know, to get the money, you know, I'm from Florida or I'm from West Virginia and I've been unemployed for 2 years and I'm making money and I could give this to my family. So they're willing to do whatever it takes to make money for their families.
And so they're coming from other states because they hear about fracking happening in this area.
I saw license plates from about 30, 35 states on a regular basis.
Yep.
Kevin?
Same, yeah, ditto. It's the same. I was just a bit west of Williston. Williston, for your listeners, is other previous claim to fame is where the basketball coach Phil Jackson, his boyhood home. Other than that, it's also known to be, it's near an area where Lewis and Clark met back on the convergence of the confluence of the Yellowstone and Missouri rivers, and the only other claim to fame the area has, Teddy Roosevelt lived part of his final years out in that area just south of Williston. But other than that, it looks what you'd think like the set of Bonanza looks like, big open prairies. And now on the hillsides, you have oil rigs pumping out, you know, in that back and forth motion. It's kind of surreal, these kind of, you know, cows in front of a big natural gas flame and a flare, rather. Quite disruptive. I think the thing that I found so striking about it, and I should, with the caveat that I visited Towanda, Pennsylvania, where the natural gas fracking is happening, and it's a trend that's similar, and out in Calgary, Alberta, by the oil sands, when that was really taken off, 2004, 2005. So this is a familiar theme. It seems to unveil itself in the same way, but I think Evelyn is right on target. I don't think people have looked We know the water issues. We know the truck issues. People haven't looked at how it changes a community, and that's what I was after. You know, people talk about jobs all the time. They don't say that these jobs often aren't going to the locals because many of them don't have the skill set needed. But then these locals are literally being pushed out of the places they grew up because they can't afford to pay rent.
Mm. Absolutely. You know,
what happens to them? Where do they go? There's a diaspora.
Kevin, you report in Montana, in this area, Sydney, the rents have actually tripled.
Yeah, yeah. It's outrageous. And they've built Sydney, which is about 120 miles from Williston, if my memory is right. It now has about five hotels. It's built three new ones, and they're still full up. And right behind the courthouse, they're building all these new new homes and condos. But that's not going to help the locals because that's going to go to the managers of these rig projects. So the dynamic of the people with less resources isn't going to change and may be amplified.
And Evelyn, you report that in Fort Berthold, North Dakota, poor residents are being evicted.
Right, and they have the added problem there of there's nowhere to build. That area doesn't have the sewage treatment plants, it doesn't have the sewer systems, it doesn't have the infrastructure for housing. So when people are pushed out, there is nowhere to go, and that's what's going on there. And rents have also doubled and tripled in those towns around the res.
And around the res, you're talking about a 40% unemployment rate.
It was 40%. That has dropped. That's definitely part of the other side of it. There has been an increase in jobs, absolutely. But a lot of the res residents don't qualify for them. They don't have those commercial driver's license, which are gold now in the oil patch, or they don't have the technical skills to do some of those jobs.
To the credit, they are doing drug testing, which they weren't. I didn't see any of that in the East Coast. I did see that in Montana. I don't know about North Dakota, but they seem to have a pretty effective drug testing program. So they can't control who's coming up. One of the things that came out in our story was that a lot of people with felony convictions would come up there because there's most states to get have someone extradited back. They can only be extradited back from three contiguous states. So if you go all the way up to Montana with a felony record, you know, they can't send you back. So even if they're turned down for a job in the oil fields, they're still hanging out there, living out of a car, living out of a trailer. Felons with outstanding arrest warrants, and nobody can do a thing about it.
Yes, that's true. There was a lot of talk when I was on Fort Berthold of all the felons, and there are, you know, wanted posters all over the library, you know, child, you know, registered sex offenders. Yep. There's a lot of that.
Some of this sounds so surreal. I have to say.
It's so surreal.
Because in your piece, Evelyn, you write that the deer have disappeared.
They're not even sure how that happened. Was it all the truck traffic? And I can't overestimate the kind of traffic that I saw that I've never, ever seen anything like this in my life. And I'm from New York.
two-lane highways.
Right.
Huge trucks in all directions.
And it's day and night. When I was there in July, it didn't get dark until about 10:30, and so it was like broad daylight. And even after that, just trucks day and night.
That is Evelyn Nieves, just back from Fort Berthold, North Dakota, home of the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation. You can find her piece, extensive reporting, at yourcallradio.org. Also, Kevin Hall, national economics reporter with McClatchy, recently back from Sydney, Montana, talking about the oil boom there. You can also find his piece at our site. And you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. What questions do you have about the oil and fracking boom and how it's affecting small towns across this country? Where are you seeing reporting about this? What questions do you think we need to be asking? And I'm wondering, is any of this going to come up in the presidential election? We've got the first domestic debate next Wednesday. It would be great if the moderator asked some kind of question about this. 866-798-8255. And let's hear from Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max.
Good morning. Excellent program as usual. And
thank you
for it and for taking my call. A bit of good news and bad news about fracking. The good news is that the administration of François Hollande in France has banned fracking, even under the rubric of research on fracking in France. However, this thing is spreading all over the world like a disease. It's being done in South Africa, in Poland, in Russia, Mexico, and elsewhere. So it's a real problem that people are going after what they perceive to be the cheap energy source, which is far from that, of course, given its environmental impact. But I'll stop here and thank you for a good program.
All right, thank you. What about California? Evelyn, have you been following fracking in California?
I think it's not going to get the pass that it's getting in North Dakota. North Dakota doesn't even want to use the word fracking. They don't want to hear the word fracking. Whereas California, there's already legislation to let's get a hold on this.
What do you mean North Dakota doesn't want to hear the word?
North Dakota has very minimal regulations for fracking, and it's decided that the EPA shouldn't tell it what to do in terms of regulating fracking or having any rules, that it would have its own rules. And so far, the rules for fracking in North Dakota are, yes, tell us the chemicals that you're using, but we're not going to tell the public. You could just tell us.
Yeah, there's very little federal regulation. I think most listeners would be surprised mm-hmm. at what a small role the federal government has over this. What little the federal government has been working on has largely been on federal lands so that it could show the way. And if you look at on the campaign question, the Romney campaign has talked about expanded oil production on federal lands. Well, that says nothing about where it's happening. Where it's happening, you know, we are now a net, we produce more of our oil than we consume from imports, in large part, obviously, the Gulf of Mexico, but in a good measure, this new stuff from fracking. And a lot of that is happening without well-off federal lands, and nobody is regulating it. The states, Montana, just west of where Evelyn was in Trenton, I don't know if you got through Trenton or not, Evelyn?
I didn't.
Trenton has an open-air sewage pit where they pump the slurry. And they have, as I understand it, at least as it was explained to me, they have a lining at the bottom of it, but they don't line the sides, so the sludge is dissipating, it's evaporating, and there's nobody to look at it. There's no, the state isn't interested in looking at it, best what I've been told. The feds don't really have, technically, you could argue they could make a case, but the Obama administration has actually been the most fracking-friendly administration in the history of the country, yet they can't say that. They can't refute this idea that they're against drilling because it hurts their base.
Can you elaborate on that, Kevin? What do you mean they've been the most fracking-friendly administration in the history
of the country? Well, as Evelyn was alluding to, you know, the federal government has powers, and everything from the Clean Air Act and Clean Water to a bunch of federal legislation that they could go in and challenge some of this if they wanted to. But I think they understand it's one of the few sectors that's adding jobs, and it's such a hyper-politicized issue that they're just, you know, letting it happen. And it has the benefit of offsetting foreign oil. So, you know, they're getting some of the benefit without claiming the political credit for it. They can't, you know, run an ad saying, you know, I've created X number of energy jobs and this much more barrels of oil because it goes against their base. But so, you know, they get the negatives of not doing enough when they've done more than his predecessor.
Just to add to what Kevin said on the reservation, well, that is regulated by federal law, but the reservation and North Dakota have convinced the EPA to let North Dakota's state laws govern fracking on Indian land as opposed to BIA, so that the reservation will have the same minimal regulations and laws as the rest of North Dakota. In other words, go fracking.
Who is doing the fracking exactly? I mean, we all know the sort of oil company names, but what about the companies behind the fracking?
Exxon, Halliburton, the biggest names in the industry.
So the same names that we already know.
Right.
And yeah,
although in Montana, not so much. I think in the Williston area, yes. In Montana, I think it's smaller companies. I may be wrong on this, but my sense was it was smaller and mid-sized companies, a lot of wildcatters. And the downside to the wildcatters is that, you know, they're more interested in the buck than the big guys. The big guys have brand reputation. They have to protect in some way. Whereas I think the smaller wildcatters are a little more freelance.
And the small companies, what's their background? Where do they come from?
Well, I suspect a lot of them may have no background whatsoever and have pulled together finances. And in another case, you know, obviously Houston, I was having a conversation yesterday actually with someone who was telling me that one of the biggest shortages in the law field right now is oil and gas lawyers. because there's so much merger and acquisition activity going on in the oil sector because of the fracking. So you go in there, you make a lease, you strike a deal with a landowner, you drill, you find something, you sell yourself to a bigger guy who's bought up three of them, and now he's three times the size he was. You know, I think that's how it's working.
Mm. Right, that's the other thing that's going on is flipping. Somebody buys an oil lease and then sells it to a larger company for a lot more money. So there's money being made that way as well.
So what did you hear from locals? Because I know that obviously they want jobs, and they're so desperate for jobs that they'll take these, even though a lot of the people you both interviewed said, we had no idea things were going to change this drastically.
Yeah, if I can jump in, forgive me, Evelyn, because I wanted to go back to this earlier point on jobs, too, about people in poverty and being pushed out. Right now, I won't say the name of the national fast food chain that's known internationally, because I couldn't use the name in the story, but people can put two and two together. Big fast food chain all over the world. They're bringing people in on student visas, college kids from Macedonia, the Ukraine, Russia, half of the year, part of the year. And when it's winter, when it's summer south of the equator, they're bringing Brazilians and Peruvians to work in this fast food chain because they can't get people locally. They're offering more than $10, $15 an hour, and they can't get people because even if you were making that much money, you couldn't afford to pay rent there. Where would you live?
Or you couldn't find a place to live. That's true. I heard $20 an hour for that large, we shall not name it, corporation.
So how does this work, bringing kids over from Macedonia?
Well, they bring them over on visas where they get 3-month visas, ostensibly to learn English. They're putting them in three trailers. And so these poor kids are coming over from the Ukraine, getting, you know, bunking up three or four to a trailer, I guess. And that's their English learning experience, and they're out in the middle of nowhere in an oil town. And that's what they have to do to fill these jobs. So again, it goes to the heart that people talk about jobs. And the day that our story ran, Senator Murkowski of Alaska had just toured North Dakota and had put out a big press release, you know, extolling, you know, what a great thing this is, all these jobs that are being created and the economy that's boosting up and all these good things that are happening. And no mention of all what it means to the community. And, you know, I tried to stay away from the issue of is fracking good or bad? Is, you know, do we need the oil, do we not? And just narrowly looked at the focus of what is this doing to a community? Mm. And that a politician could go there and not ask that question or see it in front of there. And Evelyn was there in Williston. She saw, you know, 7 miles out on the highways, it looks like a giant oil staging ground. You know, both sides of the highway full of drill repair shops, tire repair shops, bobcats and earth moving equipment. It's as if you've gone to a oil drilling emporium.
It's true. It's very ugly. It's a very ugly scene out there.
We've got just about 8 minutes left with Kevin Hall, economics reporter with McClatchy, and Evelyn Nieves, independent reporter. And we'd love to hear from you. How is your local paper covering fracking? I just found a long piece from Capital Public Radio that says the fracking fight is about to come to California, where the U.S. Energy Information Administration estimates that there is 15 billion barrels of recoverable oil, mostly trapped in the tight rock of California's Monterey Formation. So how is your local paper covering this very important issue? And what questions do you have for today's guests, Kevin Hall and Evelyn Nieves, about what they found in North Dakota and Montana? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Aaron in Oakland. Hi, Aaron. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. I'm confused about two points that I would love clarification about. Number one, I thought the original scandal about fracking was that Dick Cheney had engineered it so that the fracking industry was exempt from the federal environmental laws. So I'm not clear why the man from McClatchy is saying that the Obama administration could be exercising more regulatory control. And then the second question I'm confused about is, why can't we name the story you're talking about? If this is journalism, why is there some... What's the reason you can't name the mega story you were talking about?
Well, I can tackle that simply because this person wasn't authorized and could lose their job, and had publicly talked about it in the past and had been warned that if they talk about it, they could lose their job. So it's in fairness to protecting them,
okay.
At least not using their name. On the first question about federal law, Evelyn, jump in if I'm wrong, but I don't think there are laws that allow you to exempt an industry from complete regulation. There are numerous federal laws that supersede and would apply.
That's true, though the EPA had proposed and has proposed new regulations for fracking, but decided to hold off on them until after the election. Mm.
And what could the Obama administration do?
Well, Clean Water Act.
Enforce it?
Yeah, I mean, the groundwater contamination, I think. They're certainly doing research about the deep water fracking. In this case, we should make a distinction. The fracking that has been so contentious on the East Coast is natural gas, for the most part. Out here in North Dakota and Montana, it's oil.
Right.
And the natural gas, they're not even capturing the natural gas. It's just being flared off, which has its own environmental issues.
And what would you add to that in terms of what the administration could do?
Well, I agree with Kevin that they could start enforcing the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act in the Fort Berthold Reservation. The amount of illegal dumping that's being done, there's just not enough public safety officers. There are not enough cops, in other words, to get a handle on this. And I was told by officials of the res that they just have absolutely no idea what's being dumped and where, and they just get police calls all day long from people saying, I saw a truck dump this or that, and it's just being done, and nobody's doing anything about it.
Yeah, I can jump in with another example from Towanda in Pennsylvania, which is right up by the north, in northern Pennsylvania by the New York border, when I was there a little less than a year ago. One of the local fire chiefs, bumped into him. He was working at a operation where they transfer sand from rail cars into trucks, the sand that's used to pump into the slurry that they use for fracking. He said, you know, it's great. We needed these jobs. I don't know where we'd be without these jobs, but I got to tell you, my other hat is volunteer fire chief, and I get called every time there's an explosion, and I don't know when I arrive on the scene whether or not I'm going to be allowed in, whether they have any data. I won't even know whether I get to see an injured worker. So, you know, you think about OSHA and federal labor laws. They've ceded ground to the industry and basically said, you guys come up with best practices. And, you know, the big guys, again, for brand reputation, Chesapeake has been very aggressive with best practices. But, you know, they're the big guy. They're not all the small wildcatters.
And what was it like for you, too, in terms of being received by these communities when you said you were from a different area and you wanted to tell their stories? Evelyn?
I found people really relieved to be able to tell their stories, to be able to complain to me, to say, you know, people think we're like, yay, you know, we're rich now, and everybody's miserable. I heard this from the editor of the local paper. He goes, anyone you talk to will say they're miserable. And I started talking to people, and yes, everyone said, even the ones who were getting royalty checks, thousands a month, that they would go back to the way things were rather than have this money.
Life as they knew it is gone.
And it is.
The point I tried to make in this story is it's quaint if you live in San Francisco, you live in New York, you think, you know, people there said the biggest thing, every single person, I mean, to a one, said, I hate the fact that I have to lock my doors, I can't leave my keys in the car. This is the kind of place that everybody knew everybody at the grocery store.
Yep.
You just can't emphasize that enough, that it is the definition of what small town life was, and that's gone for them. This is another debate. Is it the greater good of the country and yada yada? But, you know, we were focused on our piece, at least narrowly, on how does this transform a community.
And where I was, the elders don't even leave their houses anymore. They're scared to go outside. They're scared they're going to get hit by trucks, because so many people have been hit by trucks.
Did you two look at the local papers? Are they covering these issues?
Yes, the local paper. But again, the local paper can't keep up. The local paper that where I was in Newtown has one reporter.
One reporter for the whole paper?
Yep.
Wow. And what about you, Kevin?
Well, the local guy had reached out to me, had heard I was in town, and then wasn't able to catch up because that was in Miles City, and I was just on the road. You know, again, normally I would do more of that, but in this case, I was really interested in talking to people, kind of unvarnished. You know,
right.
How are you looking at this? If your listeners, I presume you guys are putting the stories on the website.
Oh, they're there already, yeah.
if you look at the slideshow, you'll see Carrie Finsas, and you'll see her standing in front of a natural gas flare. She lives next to a railroad track bought 34 years ago. Train used to pass two times a week. So now the train goes by three times a day, but right next to her yard, it's become the oil literally comes out of the ground and right into the tank cars. So all day long, she's hearing clanking of the rail cars being repositioned. Every time they go over the tracks, the bells blow, and she's got Christmas lights, basically. She's got a flare, you know, 50, 60 feet from her house.
I've never been to a noisier place than this little town on this reservation where, in order to talk to people on the street, we had to shout over the truck noise.
How do you think that, I mean, these pieces take time. I mean, Evelyn, again, Evelyn had to sleep in a Walmart parking lot 75 miles away from Fort Berthold, North Dakota, because there was no place to stay there. You stayed a week. These stories take time. You've got to talk to people, do a lot of investigative reporting, which unfortunately we don't have much of nowadays, although there are some really great nonprofits. So many. What do you think about how this is or is not being covered in the national media?
I think it's being covered.
I think it is, too. Not enough.
We don't have a very active electorate. I think that's a bigger issue. Our papers have run it. Evelyn's got attention. The New York Times has done quite a bit on fracking. It really goes down to the electorate and who they elect and what they ask of their elected officials.
Also, I think North Dakota has been lucky in its location because it is so remote. It's hard to get to. It's impossible to stay anywhere there. It's a very difficult story to do physically.
Yeah.
So,
expensive,
you know,
too.
And expensive, yes, very expensive. So North Dakota has been very lucky in that it hasn't gotten as much attention as it ought to.
In places like Maryland, New York, there are places where it's been banned or is further study. I think the newspapers have written an awful lot about that. So I think it's getting covered. But to me, at least, it just goes back to this issue of accountability. What are you asking of your elected official?
Right. And will this issue come up during the next, 5 weeks or so?
Oh, I don't think so.
Bet on it.
Kevin Hall is an economics reporter with McClatchy Newspapers. Evelyn Nieves is an independent reporter. She wrote this piece for the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. You can find their stories at yourcallradio.org. Kevin and Evelyn, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
And thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor and Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in San Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Join me, David LaTulipe, as we explore the life and music of Franz Schubert.
For now, let's just be aware that Franz was a compulsive composer, a disorder that today would likely be treated with anti-anxiety medication, but in Schubert's day could only be dealt with by writing more music.
Explorations in Music, starting Monday, October 1st at 9 p.m., right here on KALW.
This is Local Public Radio, KALW, San Francisco. Stay tuned. Coming up next from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. It's 11 o'clock.
Hello, welcome to World Have Your Say on the BBC. I'm Ben James. We reflect the discussions you're having around the world.
I've gone to what seems like a very ordinary neighborhood on all my recent visits. Each time, it told an extraordinary story.
As the conflict continues, we're going to spend the next hour talking to journalists who've recently been inside Syria. Our guests will answer your questions about the things they've seen and the people they've spoken to, as well as compare experiences with each other. We have correspondents who've been in Damascus, Aleppo and elsewhere, some on visits sanctioned by the Syrian government, others in areas controlled by opposition groups. If you want to ask them a question, you can post at facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay, and the hashtag on Twitter is WHYS.